You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, they're back after 17 years. If you live in parts of the Midwest and the Eastern United States, you know what I'm talking about. Trees, bushes, fences, sidewalks, anything that doesn't move, anything's becoming the temporary home for returning cicadas. And the air will be filled with their singing, the sounds of summer. They're brood 10 cicadas, and they're expected to fully emerge in very large numbers over the next few weeks. Maybe you'll be lucky enough to see them. Could this be the largest insect emergence ever in recorded history on Earth, even bigger than the 1875 outbreak of Rocky Mountain locust in Nebraska? Back then, millions of locusts descended on Dodge County, Nebraska, blackening the sky, turning day to night, and clearing a swath of vegetation in their path, just like a wildfire. But guess what? Just 30 years later, the Rocky Mountain locusts, well, they were gone. This hour is our Spring Bug Show. We'll talk about what we can expect from this year's cicada emergence and the mystery of what happened to the Rocky Mountain locust a century ago. So if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. My guest, Keith Clay, is a professor of biology and the director of the IU Research and Teaching Preserve at Indiana University in Bloomington. He joins us from the studios of member station WFIU in Bloomington. Welcome to the program, Dr. Clay.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Good afternoon to you. Jeffrey Lockwood is the author of Locust, The Devastating Rise and Mysterious Disappearance of the Insect That Shaped the American Frontier. It's out this week from Basic Books. He's also a professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. He joins us today from Wyoming public radio station KUWR in Laramie. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Keith Clay, people have started to see already the cicada emerging. Why does it take 17 years? What's going on there?
Nobody knows for sure, but when they do come out, they come out in enormous numbers, and that provides some protection from predators that can't possibly eat them all. Mm-hmm. There are also 13-year cicadas that come out every 13 years, so they certainly have an unusual and elongated life cycle, but I think the bottom line is nobody can say for sure why it's 17 years and not 19 or 13 or 11.
But you have said that this cicada emergence is likely to be the largest insect outbreak on Earth.
Yeah, I did.
And sticking by that story?
Yes. When you consider the density of cicadas that can potentially emerge from just 1 acre of ground up to 1.5 million and extrapolate across the geographical range of brood X, we're talking many, many trillions, perhaps tens or hundreds of trillions of periodical cicadas emerging this week.
Is there enough for them all to eat? I mean, and to grow that many trillions of cicadas? I mean,
they've spent the last 17 years eating. They're parasites on the root systems of trees and shrubs, and they've been slowly growing, sucking sap. And considering the large amount of forest cover in the eastern United States that's converting the sun's energy into food resources, the cicadas are first in line to tap into that.
I'll bet. Jeff Lockwood, the number of cicada, I mean, the number to beat, for them to beat, we're talking about how many are emerging. Maybe a locust outbreak that happened more, what, than 100 years ago? Tell us about that. July 1875 in Dodge County, Nebraska.
Yeah, that was the largest known swarm of the Rocky Mountain locust, and it is perhaps best described as the perfect swarm in that all of the environmental and ecological and climatological factors necessary to coalesce locusts from all the way probably from Texas up through the Midwest came together and formed this gigantic swarm that the likes of which has never been recorded anywhere else in the world. So it, I guess, if we had to try to match the cicadas out here in the West, we'd put forward our locusts and see where it falls out.
And so they would, you know, you've seen pictures in movies of locust herds in other parts of the world. I guess this was happening, as you say, right here in the U.S. What kind of damage could a swarm of locusts do?
It was absolutely phenomenal in terms of the impact that it had on the pioneers and the settlers of the West. When the swarm would descend, you'd be looking at a bristling blanket of insects that would just cover the ground and cover houses. And they would consume virtually everything. Gardens, the settlers would talk about gardens virtually melting before their eyes. The corn stalks would be disappearing and just look like ghosts as the locusts ate further and further into the fields. And they would, once they were done there, they would chew on leather and clothing and blankets and virtually anything that had marginal nutrition or a source of water would go down their gullets.
So did they just totally wipe out that whole generation of settlers, the farmers?
Well, they certainly did a tremendous amount of damage, and some of the settlers were forced to abandon the land and either head further west or a number of them headed back east. There were cases in which they were left without food. Of course, these were, at this point, our subsistence farmers, so they rely on what they grow to eat. And so there was some death by hunger, and because of an intervention of the U.S. military, actually, following this huge outbreak, we managed to more or less narrowly avert a fairly large-scale famine in the West.
Keith Clay, do cicadas work the same way? Are they going to just emerge and eat everything in sight?
No, actually, the adults that are emerging right now do not require feeding at all. That's what they've been doing up to this point. They are capable of sucking sap from trees, the branches, and bark, but they don't need to, and probably most don't. They do a lot of damage, but that damage, the visual damage, occurs when they're laying their eggs, which they insert into pencil diameter twigs, and oftentimes it kills those twigs, resulting in large losses of foliage and kind of a brown appearance. And young trees can certainly be killed. Cicadas don't move around a lot like these swarms of locusts. And it was interesting hearing the description, reminiscent of huge flocks of passenger pigeons, so dense they would block out the sun. And it's kind of ironic. They're extinct now, of course. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the locusts are also extinct. But the cicadas continue on very successfully.
Let's talk about their life cycle. They come out of the ground, they go up into the trees, they lay their eggs in the trees, and then what happens?
When they come out of the ground, which is happening right now in southern Indiana, these nymphs that are about the size of a small shrimp seek out some vertical surface, climb up, their exoskeleton splits open, and the immature adult comes out. Over a period of 6 or 8 hours, the wings expand and their body hardens up and turns jet black, and then they're ready to go. Next, the males gather together in huge swarms or choruses and sing, and the more males that get together and the louder they sing, the more successful they are at attracting females. They mate and then basically die. The females lay their eggs in branches, and then they die. And about 2 months later, the eggs hatch, and the young nymphs drop straight to the ground. And if they're lucky, they make their way into a crack or burrow into the soil and attach to a root, and the whole cycle repeats itself.
Mm-hmm. We actually have some audio of cicadas that we can listen to. Let's listen to this first sound, and you can tell us what we're listening to.
Okay. It's quite a hypnotic
some
sound.
Some chorus there.
We're looking to be hearing that for 2 or 3 consecutive weeks. That's the chorusing song of Magis cicada septendecim. This is one of 3 species of periodical cicadas that make up Brood 10. And this is the sound that you hear when thousands or tens of thousands of males are gathered together in one tree.
Do they do that day and night?
No, the calling is most loud during the heat of the afternoon. They pretty much shut down at night, thankfully.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Lockwood, now there was a real mystery about what happened to all those locusts back there in 1875, right?
Yeah, exactly. The disappearance. I mean, to go from this largest swarm, and if you could, you know, just imagine this swarm. The records indicate that it covered about 198,000 square miles. So that swarm, as it passed over the Midwest, would have covered the areas of Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island.
All at once?
All at once. A single swarm. Okay, so that's what happens in the 1870s. And 30 years later, well, actually in 1902, the last living Rocky Mountain locust is seen. So that has to be I call it perhaps the biggest ecological murder mystery in the history of North America, how something that prevalent could disappear in such a short period of time.
And literally, did they peak and then peter out over those 30 years, or were they like here today, gone 30 years later, like overnight?
Well, it was a bit of a diminishing series of outbreaks. They shouldn't make the mistake of giving the impression that there were this many locusts every year. During outbreaks, they would, of course, cover tremendous areas of the United States. Probably two-thirds of the country could be invaded by them. But then in intervening years, in the other years, they would be seen not at all. Nobody would report seeing the locusts, and they would sort of go into a recession and disappear, or at least people would think, although they learned pretty quickly to expect that within every 7 to 10 or 12 years, the swarms would descend again from the Rockies.
Do we know what caused suddenly the outbreaks to occur?
We think it's like modern-day locusts in the sense that it appears that they were driven largely by climate. And these being temperate locusts, they seem to do extremely well in terms of forming their swarms during drought conditions. So it was sort of like a 1-2 punch to the early agriculturalists of the West. Not only were you fighting a drought, but now here comes the locust on the horizon. And between the two of those things, it could be absolutely devastating for whole counties.
So they were there all the time, but something triggered them to just massively explode into these giant swarms.
Exactly. You can think of them sort of like a forest fire or something. There's always sort of lightning strikes, but most of them don't grow into swarms. You have to have the right set of environmental conditions, and that's what the locusts were sort of hanging out and waiting for.
1-800-989-8255. Bob in Nibblesville, Indiana. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Ira.
Have you seen your cicada yet?
No, I have not seen the cicadas yet, but I have a question. We have cicadas every year, and several cicadas in the summertime. You can hear them every night. So my question is, why did these cicadas appear all the time and not wait on this 17-year cycle?
Keith Clay?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There are probably over 2,000 species of cicadas around the world on all continents except Antarctica. And there's only a small handful that have this extended periodical life cycle. We have every summer in the Midwest the so-called annual or dog day cicadas. They're underground for 2 or 3 years, but some are coming up every single year. So it seems like they're here every summer, and indeed they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Maybe it's not a whole lot different in some ways in terms of what we have with the grasshoppers and locusts. Like we know that there's hundreds of species of grasshoppers, but there's only a few that have come up with this life history strategy that we associate with the locusts, sort of like the cicadas. Most of them, don't take advantage of these boom and bust sorts of strategies, but it seems that certain groups of insects, the periodical cicadas and the locusts, have caught on to a way of life that is associated with these entirely natural outbreaks.
And that's what we're talking about this hour, cicadas and locusts on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I know I've seen over the years, little shells around my home. I mean, we don't have the locusts here in the New York area yet. Maybe it will be coming. But over the years, you'd see in the backyard these little molted pieces, and I always didn't know what they were. Could they have been are there some kind of cicada that are normally found every year?
That's most likely what they were. there are 17-year cicada broods that extend into New York, but you wouldn't notice those shells every year.
Well, I was surprised by our caller who came from Indiana, Keith. I thought that Indiana is like ground zero for these cicadas, and he hasn't seen any yet.
Well, Noblesville is probably 60, 75 miles further north than we are, and they are temperature dependent in terms of when they emerge from the ground. Furthermore, northern Indiana is much more agricultural in nature with vast fields of corn and soybeans, and southern Indiana is a little more rugged and mostly forested, and that certainly contributes to the large populations of cicadas in the area.
Is there a limit to their range because of a cold winter, or does winter have nothing to do with it?
No, Ira, it's remarkable the distribution of periodical cicadas overlaps almost entirely with the distribution of the eastern deciduous forest. So they get west of the Mississippi, but not very far, just about as far as the trees. They get north, but not really up into Canada. They don't extend down into Florida. They're overlapping with the eastern deciduous forest.
So we might still see them here in the east sometime this year. You'd bet on that? You're betting, man?
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly where you're located.
Well, we're in New York, but so, you know, and we're waiting. And some of us are in New England, and we're saying, "Hey, we want it." This is, you know, I've heard stories of people saying, "I missed it. I really wanted to see them popping out of the ground."
Mm-hmm. Well, around here, that's happening tonight and tomorrow night. It's amazing. In my own backyard, there are 10 times more each night, each consecutive night, than the night before, and we wonder how long can this keep continuing.
Wow. Does the sound drive you nutty?
They haven't started to sing in a big way yet. They're just emerging in force, and the weather right now is kind of cool and rainy. The first warm, sunny day this weekend or Monday or Tuesday, they will really start to crank, and people will start noticing them.
Mm-hmm. I got a quick sound. I'll play another cicada noise. Wow. Sound like a siren.
Yeah, now this was the same species that makes a specific call to attract females. So females are lured into a tree by that earlier chorusing sound. Once they get there, there are 10,000 or 100,000 males. Which one do they choose?
Well, we're going to take a short break. We have to go away, but when we come back, we're going to talk lots more about cicadas and take you to the Cicada Mania. CicadaMania.com site with the creator who has got Cicada Mania. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Take more of your calls. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. A brief program note on Monday. Join Neil Conan for a special broadcast of Talk of the Nation from T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia. It marks the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling that forced American schools to integrate. And if you have a personal story about school integration, send an email to totn@npr.org. We're talking this hour about cicadas and locusts. You say you've heard enough, now you want to be motivated to act. You're wondering where to go for the latest cicada news. You want to know where they've made an appearance near you. What state was the first to see cicadas? Well, we've got a website for you. It's called cicadamania.com. You can check the most recent emergency update, complete with photos. You can take the Which Cicada Are You personality test. Find the ultimate guide to cooking and eating cicadas. Good eating, too, I'll bet. Joining me now to talk about this website, cicadamania.com, is Dan Century from Metuchen, New Jersey. He joins us by phone from Middletown, New Jersey. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Ira?
Hey, you're not a scientist. How did you get interested in cicadas?
It happened because back in 1996 in New Jersey, my friends had a wedding, and Brood 2 decided to emerge at the same time they decided to have a wedding. I guess you could call them the uninvited guests.
They emerged during the ceremony, right?
Well,
there?
They had emerged like probably a week before, but during the date was set, it was too late to pull out, and they were flying and crawling all around right during the wedding ceremony.
Wow, drowning out the music, I'll bet.
Yes, a string quartet drowned it right out.
Gee. And so that prompted you to create this website.
Yep, put up some pictures from the emergence and whatnot, did some research, and people started finding the site through search engines and whatnot.
And what's your aim here?
What's my aim? I don't know. I guess my aim is to connect people with nature around them.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that, you know, people sort of lose touch with that sort of stuff.
Right.
And it's good to make that connection. And it's also, you know, I get a kick out of the human factor, all the people emailing it me and whatnot and trying to answer their questions. I guess it's
No, I get, you know, if cicada started crawling up my leg or invading my, you know, my wedding, I'd get a little ticked off about that.
Sure.
Are the visitors to your site basically pro or anti cicadas?
I would say it's a it's probably 60 pro, 40 anti.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, and some people warm up to them as it goes along. A lot of people are scared.
Right.
You know, and then they develop some sort of infatuation with them later on.
You also have some links for people who want to eat the cicadas. Have you had one yourself?
I have not had one, but I have a feeling I'll probably be cajoled into eating one at some point this year.
So you don't know if it tastes like chicken or not?
No, but I've heard it tasted like minty shrimp. I've heard mm-hmm. popcorn.
Uh-huh. So. One of the features of your site is a daily emergence update. Give us today's update.
Today's update. I list them all out. We keep hearing reports from Washington, D.C. and the Maryland area between D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and Baltimore, pretty much like Bethesda, Chevy Chase.
I can confirm hearing people from there who live there telling me the same thing. So,
cool.
Then
Virginia.
Right.
Arlington, Springfield, that same area. Tennessee. We've mm-hmm. been hearing from Greene County and Jefferson County. I'm not sure where they are, but North Carolina, so a couple reports. Kentucky, one from Louisville so far. Indiana, a ton from Bloomington.
Wow. Now, I know you're such an obvious fan of cicadas, but is there a downside to the cicadas? I mean, what happens to all these trillions of them when they die?
Oh, it's time to clean up then. I remember back to Brood 2, and people were literally cleaning them up in wheelbarrows
right.
by the bucket load. And then what do you do with them? Do you put them in the trash? Do you bury them in your backyard? Because if you don't, they will stink. And, you know, they will, you know, if you leave a pile of them in your backyard, you'll have a backyard full of raccoons and possums and whatnot.
I bring my other guest and Jeffrey Lockwood, author of Locust, The Devastating Rise and Mysterious Disappearance of the Insect That Shaped the American Frontier, and Keith Clay, Professor of Biology and Director of the IU Research and Teaching Preserve at the Indiana University in Bloomington. Keith, this must be a feast, I guess, for the birds, all these cicadas coming out.
Yeah, the birds are going wild, and at the beginning of the emergence, I think they're eating virtually every single cicada, but as more and more come out every day, the number of birds is not increasing, and today or tomorrow or Sunday, the birds will be overwhelmed and they won't be able to eat all the cicadas.
They'll be lying back with a cigar.
that
big meal, huh?
And they're stuffed.
Let me go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Carl in Tallahassee. Hi, Carl.
Hey, hello. I'm actually listening to the first of our annual cicadas right here.
Huh.
They're just beginning to sing. Noticed one this morning, very small one. But folks down here, kids particularly, like to take the pupa husk and stick it on fuzzy shirts and decorate themselves with it.
Hmm.
But I had heard a reference to eating them and wondered if either of the cicada folks could tell any more about where the tradition emerged and if it really is a long-standing folk tradition of, because I think the reference was back areas of Maryland. And
well, how would you prepare them?
Well, I'd heard in this reference on another NPR show about a month ago of fried cicada and cicada pie.
Hmm.
So just wondered.
Okay.
Well, there's certainly records of Native Americans eating them. It's such an abundant food source, it's literally falling out of the sky. People would be fools not to take advantage. Now, most people are grossed out by the idea of eating insects, but look what else we eat. Snails, certainly they can't be any worse than cicadas.
We're going to get mail. Send your mail to him. Okay, well,
I think most people that eat them are doing it for the sort of shock value or the novelty. I don't think anybody's adding significantly to their diet by eating cicadas.
All right, let me get a phone call in here. Let's go to John in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've driven out in Nebraska and Wyoming, places like that, and with this large grasshoppers, locust still out in the fields there, and they do a lot of damage on your vehicles. Should we be expecting anything if we drive where these cicadas are located?
Yeah, are they flying around? Are you going to get a swarm of cicadas hitting your windshield or your, you know, your radiator, anything like that in your car?
I'm sure some will accumulate on the bumper, but they don't spend much of their time flying around. Most of the time is spent just sitting rather still. But certainly you could expect to make a few collisions with cicadas in the next few weeks.
I heard a an email today from a biker that told me that he got one right in the face when he was driving down the road. So,
wow.
Got to watch out.
You got to get those, yeah. Jeffrey Lockwood, what's the difference between a locust and a grasshopper?
A locust is sort of like a grasshopper on steroids. I suppose maybe the better description is a locust is a grasshopper that has a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Most insects, like, say, cicadas, when they occur at very high densities, they might get a little bit more agitated and whatnot, but they don't really change dramatically. But a locust is a form of a grasshopper in which, when they become crowded, they change dramatically. Their color changes, their behavior changes, their physiology changes. And these changes can be so dramatic that some of the locusts of Africa and Central Asia, it wasn't until well into the 1900s that entomologists realized that the migratory and the solitary phase were the same species. They looked so different from one another. And so it's the capacity to form these immense swarms, and their bodies darken. A female locust, for example, will delay egg production in anticipation, in a sense of anticipating a long migration. She doesn't want a bunch of developed eggs in her body. So everything about the organism sort of transforms during these periods of outbreaks. And it's not a taxonomic difference between grasshoppers and locusts. It's really an ecological and a physiological difference.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Susan in Louisville. Susan, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. We have our cicadas starting here for sure. We have yesterday when I went for a walk, I saw a number of them, probably dozens, and today there were probably hundreds of them. And it's interesting, I remember 17 years ago, my children were little. I actually projected my life by 17 years, thinking, I wonder, you know, in 17 years when they come back. I think it's kind of a romantic thing to be able to see this phenomenon happening every 17 years.
So you're not afraid of them? You're not?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, they appear to be very stunned. I saw them, and I'm hearing that this is a very vulnerable time when they're first coming up and have first shed their skins. But the ones I saw today, I was trying to scoop some off the road. I know how stupid that is because they'll be just everywhere in a couple of days, but trying to scoop them off the road because there are a number of them squished on the road this morning. But we have older property and 3 acres, and we were told you could have about $1 million per acre. So I think we've got like $3 million that we're expecting in our yard.
Well,
that's what we had last time.
Well, good luck to you.
Let's not eat them. They have enough problems already. There's enough environmental stuff getting in their way. So.
All right. Talking about cicadas and locusts this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
There are some recommended recipes for locusts that came out of the 1800s. It was one of the ideas was that, well, if you can't beat them, I guess if you can't beat them, eat them or something like that. One of America's most famous entomologists seriously recommended, and he actually shipped locusts down to St. Louis specific recipes, which were developed for these things. They said they made a fine fricassee, and taste testing on the continent, and they were met with fairly favorable results. I've eaten grasshoppers before. Occasion to munch into locusts. I suspect they're very much the same. And the description of cicadas is tasting a bit like a minty shrimp. sort of resonates with those who might have eaten grasshoppers. In that shrimp and grasshoppers and cicadas are all arthropods and might have sort of a mild flavor in common.
Hmm. Now, Keith Clay, I know you'll be studying the cicada's role in the forest ecosystem. Tell us about this study. What kinds of things will you be looking at, and how do you conduct this study?
Well, we're interested in the impact of these insects, which occur at tremendous densities and biomass, more than any animal ever documented on Earth on a per-acre basis, and that are parasites on trees. What effect are they having on the forest? If all cicadas disappeared from the face of the Earth today, would it make any difference to the forest tomorrow? We know things like gypsy moth or pine bark beetles, the emerald ash borer, these invasive type insects can have major effects on the structure and dynamic of forests, and surely cicadas may also. But if all the forest is affected equally, all the trees are equally parasitized, how can we tell what effect they're having? So our major approach is to blanket large swaths of young forests with netting to keep the females from laying their eggs in branches, which also keeps the root systems free from being colonized by cicadas for the next 17 years. And we're doing this in a checkerboard pattern where the netted areas are interspersed with unnetted areas. And we will be comparing these blocks of forest and seeing whether there are any changes over the next few years or over the next 17 years.
Well, thank you very much for all of you for joining us this hour. We've run out of time. Keith Clay is professor of biology and director of the IU Research and Teaching Preserve at Indiana University in Bloomington. Jeffrey Lockwood is author of Locust, The Devastating Rise and Mysterious Disappearance of the Insect That Shaped the American Frontier, out from Basic Books. He's also an author, a professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Also, want to thank for joining us today. I forgot his name. Dan Century. Thank you. Dan Century, who's got the cicadamania.com website. And you'll be updating that every day, right?
Every day. Right. Actually, many times a day. The message board.
Thank you, Dan, for joining us. Thank you all. Talk of the Nation Science. Kevin Wade, our audio engineers are Matt Galick and George Idiart in New York, John Shelton in Bloomington. Thanks to Christine Simon at the University of Connecticut for those cicada sounds you heard this hour. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we have Molesky and Alphonse Finn. If you have comments or questions, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also leave us to the program. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.